This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Since Vladimir Putin came to power in Russia, a shocking number of his critics and political opponents have been murdered, including prominent journalists, two members of parliament, an executive in Russia's central bank, and former KGB agent in exile Alexander Litvinenko, who died in London after getting a lethal dose of radioactive polonium. British police have completed their investigation into Litvinenko's death and submitted a file to prosecutors. The death of so many of Putin's opponents was the subject of a piece in last week's New Yorker by our guest, journalist Michael Spector. He traces the roots of the killings and their relative toleration among Russians to the country's wrenching transition from communism to a market economy and the lack of a tradition of independent journalism. Michael Spector was the New York Times Moscow bureau chief in the late 90s. He's been a staff writer for the New Yorker since 1998. Terry spoke to Spector earlier this week.
Michael Spector, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, you write that 13 journalists have been killed in Russia since 1999. Can you go through this morbid roll call of which journalists were killed and what was done to them?
13 journalists have been killed since Vladimir Putin became president. They share a couple chilling characteristics. One is ugly deaths, and the other notable one is that they were opponents of the Kremlin. Different people were shot. One man who I knew fairly well, Yuri Shikachikin, who worked at Novaya Gazeta along with Anna Politkovskaya, who was also killed recently and who I wrote about in last week's issue of the magazine, died mysteriously while he was investigating nefarious connections between the FSB, which is the Federal Security Agency, the successor to the KGB, and mafia and government. He died. Doctors said he died of an allergic reaction, though they could never say to what. And his family is convinced that he was poisoned in the manner of Alexander Litvinenko, who was not a journalist, but he was a former FSB agent who was murdered through radiological assassination in London in November.
Yeah, you described the Litvinenko murder as the first known case of nuclear terrorism perpetrated against an individual. Nuclear terrorism because he was killed with polonium-210, which is a rare radioactive isotope. What are the theories in Russia about who is behind these murders and what the motivation is?
Well, there isn't enough time in this show or in our lifetimes to go through every theory because there are thousands of them. Here are some facts. Alexander Litvinenko was an extremely outspoken opponent of Vladimir Putin. He was asked to kill Putin's most famous opponent, Boris Berezovsky, 7 years ago and instead defected to London, became a member of the Berezovsky camp, has said that Putin was responsible for starting the Second Chechen War, which began when a bunch of buildings in Moscow blew up, killing 300 or more people, and which the government blamed on Chechen separatists without any real evidence whatsoever. Litvinenko was poisoned, and there seems to be very little doubt that it would have required a sophisticated organization to bring an isotope of polonium, which is rare and which is almost exclusively manufactured in Russia, into London, slip it into a drink so that he could die. It's an unusual poison because if you touch it, you won't get sick. You have to ingest it. But if you ingest even a microgram, you'll die, and you'll die a very ugly way.
Well, a law was passed by the Russian parliament, the Duma, that permits the assassination of, quote, enemies of the Russian regime abroad. Is it believed in Russia that Litvinenko is a victim of this law?
It's certainly believed by many people, and I guess I would have to say I would be one of those people. As you asked in your last question, there are many theories. There are theories that Putin's opponents had him killed to make Putin look bad, that Putin personally had him killed because he hated him. I can't personally believe, though I will never know, nor will I think anyone know, that the president of Russia actually had him killed. But I do think there's an atmosphere where you can go out and kill people who you oppose and know that you're not going to get prosecuted. And part of that problem is that last year the Duma passed a law at the president's behest, which basically said if there's an enemy of the Russian regime abroad, we can kill him. And if you kill him, it'll be fine. And It just seems somewhat tailor-made to kill people like Alexander Litvinenko, though definition of enemy of Russian regime is a rather vague term these days.
And I find abroad a little vague, too. Does it mean like a foreigner who's an enemy of the regime or a Russian who has gone to another country to visit or to live? Are they an enemy abroad?
Well, this is like asking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. I believe most people felt that the meaning of it was Russian defectors, people like Litvinenko, who had turned against the country. But it isn't legally the case that it means that, and it could mean anyone that opposes the government. In terms of the law, I mean, you know, I don't believe that any country can pass a law saying it's okay to kill other people's citizens, but that basically is what it says.
Has there been any attempt to investigate the murders of journalists or of political or business people who were believed to have been murdered by the state?
Yes, there have been attempts. They don't seem to be very wholehearted, and the reason I say that is because of the 13 journalists who died in the last 7 years, there have been zero convictions, and almost no one has been apprehended yet. And in the rare cases where people were apprehended, the trial was a mistrial, or it was very clear that they were low-level people. Paul Klebnikov is an American who was the founding editor of the Russian edition of Forbes. He was gunned down outside his office. His murderers are still at large. And I actually do believe the Russian government is somewhat forcefully trying to prosecute that, but they're not having a lot of luck. And again, I think part of it is even when they want to, there is an atmosphere there where, you know, go kill people. It's okay. And people shoot people in the head there and walk away and people see it and they're not reported. Anna Politkovskaya, who was the most famous journalist and the one who died on October 7th, was shot in her elevator 4 times on a Saturday afternoon, the last time just inches away from her head. They call this in Russian kontrolny vystrel, which means control shot. It's a totally common term in Moscow. Everyone knows it. Housewives know it. When normal people know that term, it's not really a good thing for your society.
Now, as you've pointed out, you know, there have been 13 journalists who have been murdered in Russia since 1999 when Putin became the president. So how has the press been covering the murder of journalists?
The press has changed dramatically, and their ability to cover events has been altered quite a bit. When I lived in Russia, which was in 1994 through 1998, there were many problems, but the press was vibrant and vigorous and did what it thought it ought to do, sometimes for better or worse. But there were lots of voices, and one sort of felt that people could go out and try and find out the truth. These days, it's much more complicated. You're allowed to write what you want, as long as you write it for a newspaper that nobody reads. Most people see TV, and that's all they see. TV is totally either completely owned by the Kremlin or owned by organizations, political organizations, or most importantly, businesses like the giant gas and oil concerns, Gazprom and Rosneft, who are basically arms of the state. So TV is so tightly controlled, and 95% of information people get is from TV, that all these other investigations are somewhat meaningless. You know, it is the case that you can go onto the internet and people write what they want and see what they want, and I don't believe there's censorship there at all. It's also the case that very few people, once you get outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, and even in those cities, either have access to or really get their information from the internet.
Can you describe how the TV networks became owned by the state or by companies that function, as you describe it, as corporate arms of the state?
Yes, I can. And when I was there, the first Chechen war started about when I got there and lasted almost 2 years. And it was a bloody war, and the Russians knew that it was a bloody war because they saw it every night, particularly on a station called NTV, which stands for Independent Television Network, which was owned by one of the very rich Russian so-called oligarchs named Vladimir Guzinski and run by a man named Igor Malashenko. And it was sort of like in America during the time of Vietnam. I mean, people were shocked. They turned on their TV at night and they saw their kids getting killed and they saw a city being destroyed, a countryside being laid waste. And it very quickly turned the Russian people against that war and against the president, President Yeltsin, whose popularity plummeted dramatically, in part, large part because of that and also because of economic chaos that reigned. Vladimir Putin wasn't about to let that happen. And when he became president, he made sure that these major networks were owned either by companies, they just bought them. In the case of NTV, it's almost like The Godfather. They just made an offer you couldn't refuse, and if you did refuse it, they upped the offer, and if you refused that, then you were prosecuted and hounded out of the country. Vladimir Grudzinski now lives in Israel. I don't think that he would last 1 hour on the street in Moscow if he were to return.
The state-controlled energy company Gazprom took over the TV station NTV in the middle of a broadcast. Would you describe what happened?
Well, they took it over. They bought it. They so-called bought it. It's not the type of purchase that we consider a normal purchase where people offer fair market value and buy things. But they got it. And then they just said, we're going to change things. And a man named Andrei Norkin, who is an extremely brave and intelligent broadcaster, was on the air trying to explain to his viewers, of which there were still millions, what was going on. And they simply cut him off. They just cut him off. It was like the old Russian Soviet days. The television went to test patterns, and Norkin and his gang were out. And, you know, within an hour or two, a bunch of people speaking pablum were given the news.
Before the state basically took over control of the TV networks in Russia, they were owned by the new oligarchs, the really wealthy people who prospered after the collapse of communism. You write a little bit about journalism, what journalism on television was like then. And you write about how some of the journalists, after a while, were so concerned that there was going to be a return to communism or to neo-communism that the journalists started taking sides and even slanting the news. What are some examples of that?
Well, there's one particular example. It's a very major example, and it changed Russia in a significant and maybe very depressing way. Boris Yeltsin, as I said earlier in this conversation, had become extremely unpopular by 1996 when he was running for re-election. He was running against a guy named Gennady Zhuganov, who was the head of the Communist Party, and he was a hardcore old-line communist. And a lot of young Russians really felt they had gotten rid of communism, it was dead forever, it was never going to come back. And here was Zhuganov saying, hey, this guy's a joke. The economy is terrible. Sort of what Ronald Reagan said when he ran, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And what Bill Clinton ran on, it's the economy, stupid. This is what people care about in the world, not just in Russia or the U.S. And things were terrible. There was chaos. There was fear. There was also the sense that a great, powerful nation had been humiliated in almost unspeakable ways and become meaningless. Zhuganov played into this, and people in the liberal world, in the press world, in the world that had a stake in the new economy, some of them for worse, but a lot of them for better, said, gee, I don't want to go back to collective life. And the people who owned those networks and newspapers basically decided, hey, we're going to reelect Yeltsin. He had about 3% popularity at the time, and they pumped him up to 54% just by accentuating the positive and trashing Zhuganov like you can't believe. And the press basically, including my friends, including really good, honorable people, went along with it. They hadn't had a history of thinking about these things. And all they really knew was they didn't want communism coming back. And that was the worst thing that could happen to Russia. And they were going to stop it no matter what. And so they did.
Do you think that in any way that opened the door to the manipulation of the press now?
Yes. I think that Vladimir Putin and his people are very clever and smart. And they watched this happen. And what they took away from this was a very important lesson, which is the press is powerful. And you can use the press to manipulate voter opinions, the way people think about issues. You can bring a man down. You can destroy a company. You can turn people against a policy, a nation, if you get out there and shove it down 95% of the people's throats. And that's what happened. And they were able to do that because they were very sophisticated, and they also saw that in 1996, hey, these guys actually turned the election around. These guys have some power. Let's use it.
You mentioned that although freedoms are limited now in Russia, people are living better than they have in a long time. You know, the economy has improved, and that has a lot to do with oil. How is oil affecting Russia now?
How isn't it? Russia is basically a cold version of Saudi Arabia at this point. It exports something like 30% of the world's oil and gas. That number could go up. We live in a world now where the Mideast is a mess, where you can't rely on the oil, where we're trying to cut down, or one would like to think we're trying to cut down on what the president of our country eventually and finally called our addiction to oil. And Russia has it, and we need it. And the price of oil when Vladimir Putin assumed office was something like $19 a barrel. It fluctuated. It got up to 70. It's down around 55 or 52 now. That money goes right into the coffers of the Russian government. When he took over, all the time that I lived in Russia, the Russian government spent all its time trying to raise enough money to feed its people, to run its programs. It used to have to go to the International Monetary Fund all the time to ask permission for things. Now they have just tons of money. They don't ask permission, nor should they, nor do they need to, for anything they want to do. They have all the money in the world. And they've gone from being a debtor, beggar, humiliated country to an extremely rich, powerful, and politically potent one, and it's all because of oil. And oil prices do fluctuate. When the price of oil dropped in the 80s, it's pretty clear that it was one of the things that led to the destruction of the Soviet Union, because they didn't have a plan B, and either does Russia right now.
So who's benefiting from the oil? Like, who's financially benefiting from it?
To be honest, the entire country to some degree. A bunch of people are getting obscenely rich, but that was true under Boris Yeltsin. What is also happening is that people are living better. Average people, middle-class people, pensioners, retired people, sick people are getting better benefits. It's really remarkable. If you go to Moscow today, it's not just the case that there's a bunch of shockingly rich people, but it's also the case that working people are taking vacations and sending their kids to schools and taking better care of their parents and buying clothing from fancy stores and living like we consider ourselves to live in the West.
Putin is supposed to step down next year. Is it likely that he will?
That's like asking the question of who killed Alexander Litvinenko. There are 27,000 scenarios. I'll go out on a limb and say, sure, I think he will step down. I don't think he wants to be seen as Idi Amin. But stepping down, they're stepping down and they're stepping down. I don't think he's going to step down, move to a retirement home and play pinochle. What he has said is he intends to, quote, retain influence. He could do that in any number of ways. He could become the prime minister. He could become the chairman of Gazprom, the biggest company. There is a feeling that he may, in fact, just switch jobs with the current chairman, who's his first deputy prime minister. So will he continue as president for a third term? I doubt it very strongly. Will he stop being obvious in decision-making? I don't think that's likely either.
What's the relationship now between Bush and Putin? You know, early in the Bush presidency, he said he looked in Putin's eyes and saw his soul.
I don't pretend to know the answer to that. They seem to get along on a superficial level. Condoleezza Rice has been openly critical of the Kremlin, very supportive of free press. But these are just words. We're not doing anything in this country to try to change Russia's behavior. And by the way, either is Europe. And European companies and European governments want the oil and they want the gas. And that's what they want. And that pretty much governs all relationships.
Well, finally, I'm just wondering if your recent report from Russia, when combined with your experiences when you covered Russia from 94 to 98, have led to any, you know, new reflections about the role of the press in covering, you know, the most important political news of the day.
Well, it's not made me happy. I mean, I think one thing that's really important is that people take away the memory of what Anna Politkovskaya did, not just that she was killed, but that she spent years documenting horrible atrocities in Chechnya when no one else would go, when no one else would write it, at great cost to herself. There were other, she was ostracized, there were other attempts on her life. She never gave up because she knew it was honest, it was the truth, and it had to be done. And I think we all have to remember that that's what we do our jobs for. And it's not easy to do it sometimes. It's not easy to be brave when you know that the chances of you dying are high and the chances of you being hated are even higher. But I did take away a sense that the Russian people need to understand that better, and they don't understand it because it's their freedoms just came one day, and they never, you know, if Vladimir Putin never says, gee, from now on you can't travel to England or turn in your passports or you can't go out on Friday night, they'll have a different idea about freedom of speech. But right now that hasn't happened, and living better and seeing your kids happier and in a better school and in a warmer coat trumps an idea. And that I understand, but it's sad.
Michael Spector, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Journalist Michael Spector speaking with Terry Gross. His piece about murders of the opponents of Russian President Vladimir Putin appears in The New Yorker.